Very happy to be here.
Have you been introduced?
No.
If we hadn't been having such a nice time at dinner, we might have thought to get an intro bio from you, but let me see what I can do.
Okay, wait a minute.
We're very happy to have Sue Moon join us. Sue Moon is a very long-time Zen student and fully entrusted lay Zen teacher. She was the editor of Turning Wheel magazine, the quarterly publication of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, for many years. Let's see. I know several other things that I can't think of at the moment. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your background, Sue.
Well, that's plenty. I live in Berkeley. I know both Russ and Joe through Zen practice in the Bay Area. And we are both currently practicing with Norman Fisher, who's coming here. I saw on your schedule.
Tofu Roshi.
Oh yeah, Tofu Roshi. That's right. I wrote a book called The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi, which came out many long years ago, which is a Zen humor book about an imaginary Zen master and his advice column. It's now been called a cult classic. And I have a new book, which is called This Is Getting Old, and I'm on a kind of partly book tour here in the Southwest. I've been doing a lot of readings in California, but I've come here. I have a sister in Santa Fe, so I've been visiting her and doing some readings, and it's just really fun to be here, and I've never been here to Desert Mirror, but it's great to see this. I just love this cozy little sangha, so homey family. And so I've been doing about half the time my book things are at bookstores, and the other half of the time they've been in Zen centers or Buddhist centers. So I really like both, but it's fun to be here and be with you and be able to take a kind of more Zen perspective on the book. So I'm going to talk a little bit and read you a few pieces from the book, and also hope we'll have time for discussion and questions and comments and stuff. It's really a conversation that this book is part of. This Is Getting Old, Zen Thoughts on Aging with Humor and Dignity. And even though you're a pretty young group here, really everybody is getting older. No matter how old you are, you're still getting older. So hopefully it's of some interest to you, and you probably, even if you're not old yourself, you probably know somebody who's kind of old. So I think that, you know, it's really about impermanence. And I kind of want to have my little tagline of tonight be the idea that nothing is lacking. I just have been thinking about that a lot lately and thinking, well, who am I to talk? What do I have to say? Why did I write these essays about my experience, and why am I sitting here talking to you? And I'm an example of a human being struggling to be my full self and find out what it means to be a human being. And I'm the example I know best, and so that's my way of talking about what does it mean to be a human being and what does it mean to be getting older. But I also just really want to say that's the best that we can all offer in whatever way we do it, is to offer ourselves and our full, true, authentic selves. And that is enough, and we each have everything we need. We are not actually lacking anything at some level. And what we can most generously offer is our own true selves. I recently heard a good quote from Oscar Wilde, who said, "You might as well be yourself because everybody else is already taken." So, I'm working on that. I'm trying to be myself. And to remember that you know, I really do have everything I need. That we're each Buddha. We're all perfect. And we're all perfectly enlightened already. And sometimes it doesn't feel that way, but there's a quote, much quoted saying from Suzuki Roshi, explaining Buddha nature to his students. He said, "You're all perfect just as you are, and you could use a little improvement." So it's that sort of double thing of, you know, we have our small self and we have our big self, and they're both in the same place at the same time. And the only way we can really get to our big self is from our small self. And the small self lives inside the big self, and the big self lives inside the small self, and sometimes you can't exactly pry them apart. So with our imperfections, we're perfect in a way. So one of the ways in which we aren't so perfect, or in the more relative realm, we age, impermanence takes its toll on us, time passes, and impermanence is one of the three marks of existence that Buddha described, along with suffering or dissatisfaction and no fixed self. But impermanence is really connected to aging. It's because of time passing and because of impermanence that we age. And I started thinking about aging when, about the time I turned 60, I thought, I never really thought I was going to get old. I thought if I just took my vitamins and did my exercise, it wouldn't happen to me. But I had to admit that it was happening to me, and not in any terrible ways yet, but memory problems starting to happen, bad knees, I have really bad knees, which is why I'm sitting in a chair. And my Buddhist practice has helped me to really learn that it's good to not turn away from difficulties when there's something challenging or difficult. To just try and meet it and see what it is. And just say, oh, this is what it is. Oh, so this is how it is. And sometimes when you do that, it might not be as bad as you think it's going to be. It's not as bad to just look at it as it is to worry all about it. Sometimes it can be bad when you face it. But the only way really to work with it is to meet it, whatever it might be. And also, as a writer, my writing practice encourages me in the same way not to turn away from what's difficult and to write about what is challenging, because I can write my way into some greater understanding just as I can sort of practice my way into a deeper understanding. And also, from the writing point of view, it's not really very interesting to read about things when everything goes perfectly smoothly and nothing ever goes wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, we don't like to read novels about a perfectly happy family with a boy and a girl who always got A's in school and then went on to become a doctor and a lawyer. And that's not a very interesting novel. So it's good to really meet the challenges and to offer them, you know, as part of this conversation and that we're all having about what, you know, what is it to be a human being and how can we help each other and how can we help our parents, or how can we help the other older people we know, and how can young people and old people keep a good communication going, and old people learn from young people as well as the reverse. So I've been enjoying being part of a conversation too with this book as I've been talking and reading, and people have been talking to me. I really do feel like it's a larger conversation that's going on. So I think that I will read you a little bit from the introduction, which the end of the introduction. It annoys me when people say, even if you're old, you can still be young at heart, in order to cheer up old people. Hiding inside this well-meaning phrase is a deep cultural assumption that old is bad and young is good. What's wrong with being old at heart, I'd like to know. Old at heart? Doesn't it have a beautiful ring? Wouldn't you like to be loved by people whose hearts have practiced loving for a long time? Old age is its own part of life. In 13th century Japan, Zen master Dogen wrote, "Do not think that the firewood is before and the ash is after. Firewood is a stage unto itself, and ash is a stage unto itself. We are in the stage we are in. Let's not think of ourselves as has-been young people or as about-to-be dead people." My mother, Alice Hayes, a Syrian poet with a fondness for doggerel, put it this way. In her old age, a rickety Ms. took up learning the isness of is. Since it's not what one does, she just was and she was. Now she's gone off to be in Cadiz. Still, even the venerable Zen teacher Robert Aiken Roshi, who died a couple months ago, wonderful teacher, in an interview about being old, he was in his 80s at the time, admitted with a laugh, "I often feel like a young person who has something wrong with me." Skipping a little. Wabi-sabi is a Japanese expression for the beauty of impermanence and the imperfection of things that are worn and frayed and chipped through use. Objects that are simple and rustic, like an earthenware tea bowl, and objects that show their age, like a wooden banister worn smooth by many hands, are beautiful. I sew patches on my clothes, and I glue broken plates back together. I love mended things. I like to take pictures of old things, the spiderweb of cracks in the windshield of a truck, bright mildew on the wall of an abandoned railroad station. Teenagers pay good money for shortcuts to wabi-sabi when they buy designer jeans that are pre-faded, pre-frayed, and pre-ripped. But the true wabi-sabi look can't be made in a factory. It depends on the passage of time. In ikebana, the Japanese art of flower arranging, flowers that wilt quickly are particularly valued because they demonstrate the beauty of impermanence. The very fact that they fade makes them precious. I'm turning wabi-sabi. I study the back of my hand with interest, the blossoming brown spots, the blue veins becoming more prominent. With the other hand, I can slide the skin loosely over the bones. Can this really be bad? As I get older, I am turning into myself. Job gone, children grown and living far away, parents dead, can't backpack, can't do hip-hop. Who am I, really? Now I get to find out. So that is one of the things I feel about aging, is that there's an opportunity as one lets go of roles to find out, well, who am I really without the roles or without the labels or whatever? And of course, at every stage of our lives, this is happening to some extent too. We're shedding one role or one period and moving into another one. So just that constant process of letting go of some kind of external identification is an interesting one. But most, we do tend to have identifications. And when I was working as the editor of Turning Wheel, I had that identification. And when I retired a couple of years ago, I was really surprised by how disorienting it was not to have that name for myself or something. Not so much even with other people. It wasn't like, well, I want to tell them who I really am. But just for myself, like, well, what's the point? What am I supposed to be doing here? So it's a good opportunity, and it's a challenge as well. So I think I will read a piece that this is one of the more Zen pieces in the book, and it's about time. And I have noticed as I've gotten older that my feeling about time is changing, but you'll hear about it in this piece. When I was 49 and my sons were more or less grown, I kept a promise I had made to myself to go on a long retreat before I turned 50. I arranged a leave of absence from my job, had a set of robes sewn for me, and went to a practice period at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, deep in the coastal mountains of California. For 3 months, I followed the strict monastic schedule, meditating, studying Buddhist teachings, and working in silence at whatever I was assigned to, whether it was chopping carrots or cleaning kerosene lanterns. I didn't get in a car or hear a phone ring the whole time. Zen monks are called to Zazen by the striking of the Han, a heavy wooden block that hangs from a rope beside the temple entrance. The Han is hit with a wooden mallet in an intricate pattern that lasts for 15 minutes. And at Tassajara, where the monks' cabins stretch out along a narrow valley, a second Han, known as the Echo Han, hangs partway down the path to pass the signal along. You can tell how much time you have left to get to your cushion in the Zendo by listening to the pattern. The crack of wood on wood runs fast through the valley. Written in calligraphy on the block itself are the words, "Wake up! Life is transient, swiftly passing. Be aware, the great matter, don't waste time." One evening, somewhere in the middle of the practice period, it was my turn to hit the Echo Han, strike for strike. I stood on the dusty path, mallet in hand, like a frog on a lily pad waiting for a fly. I faced the garden where the evening sun came through a gap in the mountains and landed on a pair of apricot trees. I was poised in the brief interval between hits, waiting, and the weeks of the practice period stretched out before me and behind me into infinity. And when that next hit came to my ears, my arm lifted the mallet and whacked the board, no holding back. And then it was quiet again, and the light was still on the apricot trees, and I was ready for the next one. A couple of years ago, when I was a few months shy of being 65, I packed up my things at work. I loved my job. I had loved it for 17 years. But editing a magazine with a quarterly deadline meant that I was under constant time pressure. I wanted to retire before they had to gently push me out, before my brain wizened up right there at my desk with the phone in one hand and the mouse in the other. I wanted to have time for other things before I died. Quiet time, deep time, for writing, dharma, family and friends, and for something new and unknown. The part of me that wants to lower my bucket into a deep well and draw up cool water is sabotaged by another part. I suffer from a condition that a Zen friend calls FOMS syndrome, F-O-M-S, fear of missing something. It's a form of greed, the urge to cram as many interesting activities into the day as possible, coupled with the impulse to say yes to everything. To put it more positively, I'm curious about everything and everybody. And so, when I first retired, feeling rich with time, I signed up for all sorts of activities, classes, and projects. Each separate thing I was doing was worthwhile. I loved my Spanish class and my photography class, for example, but soon I was busier than before. Where was my deep time? Of course, you can't really measure time at all. Our calibrations are like pencil marks on the ocean. Einstein taught us that time is flexible. It passes differently for a person in commuter traffic, a person centering a lump of wet clay on a potter's wheel, or, so Einstein told us, a person approaching the speed of light in a spaceship. An hour can seem like a year, and a year like an hour. In the last days of my father's dying, he was in a lot of pain from cancer. He would often ask what time it was, and whatever the answer was, he would groan and say, "Oh no, is that all it is?" I couldn't understand why he wanted time to hurry up, because there wasn't anything that was going to happen except that he was going to die. I think the pain made time pass slowly, and he wanted to know that he was getting through it from one hour to the next. I too have had times when I wanted time to hurry by. Mostly, though, time is what I want more of. And, as I get older, it gets scarcer and scarcer. First of all, there's less of it in front of me than there used to be. Second, each year swings by faster than the one before. Third, I'm no good at multitasking anymore. I can only do one thing at a time. I think that's partly the fault of my Zen practice. So that's a good thing. And fourth, it takes me longer to do each thing. Age is forcing me to slow down. I remember impatiently watching my grandmother make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for a picnic. She got the jam out of the cupboard and put it on the blue linoleum countertop. And then she walked back across the kitchen to the same cupboard for the peanut butter. Then she did it again for the bread. It took forever. Well, not quite forever, because she did make the sandwiches and we ate them on a plaid blanket down in the meadow. Here's the amazing thing. Aging is giving me back the present moment. It's only linear time that's shrinking, and as it does, I have a better chance to enter deep time. It only takes a few seconds to slip through the crack between two hits of the Han into a timeless garden. This is what Zazen is all about. It's time out of time. It's stepping aside from activity and slowing down to a full stop. While I'm sitting Zazen, even if my monkey mind is swinging wildly from branch to branch, at least I'm not accomplishing anything useful. As the Heart Sutra says, there is no attainment with nothing to attain. It's easy to get nothing done while sitting Zazen. A person of any age can do it. But now that I'm getting older, I'm learning to accomplish practically nothing in the rest of my day as well. If the trend continues, my next-door neighbor will think I'm doing standing meditation in the backyard when I'm actually taking in the laundry. I like to bury my face in the sunny smell of the sheet on the line before I take it down. I like the slow squeak of the line through the rusty pulley as I haul in another sweet pillowcase. The laundry lines of my childhood made exactly that noise. I'm not saying I'm ready to quit. In spite of what the Heart Sutra tells me, I still have things I want to accomplish in the world beyond the laundry line. And I want to keep working with other people to help this feverish planet. I'm learning that slowing down is the way. I have to pay attention to my natural rhythms. I try to let each thing take as long as it takes, and I'm trying to put some white space back into my appointment calendar. Now, layers of time live in me. I think of this layering as vertical time, when all time flows into the present moment, as opposed to the horizontal timelines that used to appear on classroom wall charts. On the left, the beginning of bipedal human life, when our ancestors came down from the trees 4 million years ago in the Pliocene epoch. To the other end of the long line, the current Holocene epoch, in which we hominids can travel via the internet to look down at the melting polar ice cap without ever getting up from our chairs. It's all in me, in the present moment. Even though I don't have a clear recollection of our Pliocene days, this body remembers how it feels to climb down from a tree, swinging by your arms from the lowest bough, then letting go of the rough bark in your hands and dropping to solid earth like a ball into a catcher's glove. When old people get the generations mixed up and call a grandson by a brother's name, they're not exactly wrong. They're living in the deep time that Dogen calls the time being. Each moment is all being, is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. That's Dogen. I think of time as the landscape I'm traveling through on a train, and the train is my life. I can only see what's outside the window. Yesterday was Naperville, Illinois. Today is Grand Junction, Colorado. Tomorrow will be Sparks, Nevada. I just see the piece that's framed by the train window, but it's all there at once, all those places, the whole continent. I was visiting my granddaughter Paloma on her third birthday. We went to the neighborhood swimming pool and played in the shallow end, and she poured pailfuls of water over my head, pretending she was washing my hair. She looks like her father when he was a small child, when I sat on the closed toilet lid in the bathroom while he took his bath, watching him fill graduated plastic cups with water and line them up along the edge of the bathtub for Snow White and Peter Pan to swim in. My 3-year-old self was there, too, with Paloma in the pool, on another hot summer day, filling a wooden bucket from the hand pump in my grandmother's garden in order to paint the garden chairs. Playing in the pool with Paloma, I didn't think of those watery long-ago moments consciously. I didn't need to. As Paloma turned her bucket upside down over my head, long ago disappeared, and those other childhoods, those other summers, flowed over me and soaked my skin. Before we left the pool, Paloma went over to the lifeguard sitting in his elevated chair, and she held up 3 fingers and called, "Hi, lifeguard, I'm three! Threeness was in me, too. I can't be in more than one place at the same time, but I can be in more than one time in the same place. Time is not something I have, it's what I'm made of." So, that's that, and I want to read you one more short piece, and then I want to hear from you guys. This one kind of comes back to the idea I was talking about at the beginning, that really nothing is lacking. And when I say nothing is lacking, it's just something I've really come to feel more strongly through my practice. And I don't mean that there aren't people who are hungry and homeless and people and creatures who don't have what they need to sustain life, and that we need to try to work to help that. But that at some deep level in all of us, I really think there's some seed where nothing is lacking, some seed of knowledge that we have everything we need at the deepest level. And that gives me a lot of courage sometimes. This is called This Vast Life. Every morning, I vow to be grateful for the precious gift of human birth. It's a big gift, and it includes a lot of stuff I never particularly wanted for my birthday. Some of the things in the package I wish I could exchange for a different size or color. But I want to find out what it means to be a human being. My curiosity remains intense, even as I get older. So I say thanks for the whole thing. It's all of a piece. When my granddaughter, she keeps turning up in this book, she's now 4. When my granddaughter was just over 2, I visited her and her parents in Texas. She doesn't have a lot of ideas yet about how things are supposed to be or what's supposed to happen next. She's glad to be alive. I was babysitting for her one afternoon, and part of my job was to get her up from her nap. I was reading in the next room, and I knew when she woke up because I heard her chatting away to her bear. I lifted her and her bear out of her crib, and we went downstairs. While I fixed her a snack of crackers and cheese, she danced around a purple ball that was lying in the middle of the living room, singing an old nursery rhyme that she had learned in her preschool. Ring around the rosies, pocket full of posies, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. And then she sat down on the floor, kerplunk, laughing. She was fully present, fully joyful. Actually, the song she was singing is a very old chant about the plague, and the last line about the ashes refers to our mortality, but she wasn't worrying about that. In his poetic essay, The Genjo Koan, Master Dogen wrote, "A fish swims in the ocean, and no matter how far it swims, there is no end to the water. A bird flies in the sky, and no matter how far it flies, there is no end to the air." When I get unhappy about something in my life, I think, wait, no, this isn't the right life. It isn't what I want. I need to find the edge of this life and leap over the fence into a different life. But that's not how it works. My life is vast. I can't find the edge of it, just like a fish in the ocean or a bird in the sky. There's no getting out of this life, this ocean, this sky, except by dying. If I try to change oceans, I'll never find my way or my place. There's no place else to be but here, in the big mystery of it. It happened that only a few days after visiting my granddaughter, I visited an old friend in his 80s who lives in an assisted living facility. He's a Catholic priest and monk who has dedicated his life to solitude and spiritual study. He's well-read in multiple spiritual traditions, including Zen, and he's an important mentor to me. He's not well physically. He's weak, on oxygen, and confined to a wheelchair, but his mind is fine. He told me, "If I've died before, I don't remember it, but I recognize what's happening. That's where I'm going." Years ago, he had a coffin built for himself by a carpenter he knows, and it stands upright in his little apartment like a roommate, a reminder keeping him company. He sits at his table and looks out the window at a pear tree and watches its leaves turn and fall and bud again. He watches the seasons, the whole universe, in that pear tree. He reads, he prays, he receives an occasional visitor. Like my granddaughter, he is completely present in his life. Like Dogen's fish, he is swimming around in his ocean, and there is no end to the water, even in this tiny apartment. Moments after I entered his room, he was talking to me about Isaac of Nineveh, the 8th century Syrian hermit whose writings he had been reading when I came in. Like my granddaughter, he too is singing his version of Ring Around the Rosies, dancing until he falls down and turns to ashes. In between that toddler and that old man is a span of over 80 years, and most of us, in those intervening decades, tangle ourselves up in knots over the things we don't have that we want, and the things we have that we don't want. We run around trying to fix things in our personal lives and in the life of the planet. It's a good thing we do, because it's actually our responsibility to fix things. We need to fix the plumbing, for example. The toddler and the old monk aren't fixing the plumbing. They need us to take care of them, but we need them too to remind us that everything is already taken care of. the last meditation retreat I attended, well, not anymore the last, but recently, was beside the ocean, and while I was sitting, I listened to the surf. The surf is a sound of the ocean breathing. It's never still. Sometimes the sea is so loud and crashing that I crave a little silence, and so I listen for the silence between the waves. But just as one wave recedes from the shore, flowing back down the sand into the ocean, getting quieter and quieter, just before it gets silent, the next wave always breaks. The ocean never stops breathing because it's alive. As I sit on my seat in the zendo, following my breathing, I follow the breathing of the ocean, too, and I begin to breathe in rhythm with the ocean. The sound of the ocean is the sound of time passing, the sound of one moment giving way to the next. Each wave, each moment, is a gate that I pass through into the next moment. And even if I'm not sitting by the ocean, one wave of my life is still followed immediately by the next, with no completely quiet place in between. I love the vow, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. I keep giving myself away to the next moment, and the next moment receives me. I just have to step through. So I'll stop there and would love to hear from you all about
time,
age, anything that comes up for you? Impermanence.
Knees are a finite resource.
Yeah, they are. Do you have knee difficulties?
Yes, when I lived at City Center, they had some terraces out back that are like 3-foot-high blocks of concrete, several of them that lead from down at the street level to up at the back level, and I was climbing up them one night from my parking space, and I put my foot on all my weight up on one of them, and slipped and smacked down 3 feet down.
Oh my God.
On
Ouch.
My left knee. Mm-hmm. And fast forward 12 years, and here we are.
Hmm. And, yeah, well, that wasn't aging, but
no,
it was impermanent. I mean, it is true that.
It didn't bother me for a long time.
Oh, really?
I took up yoga a few months ago, and suddenly it sprang too painful.
Oh. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Where I was heading with that was that even if we can sit cross-legged easily now, or can remember when we could do that, eventually probably the time will come when we will not be able to do that. So probably it would be good to start to get comfortable with that idea sooner rather than later, so it won't be such a horrifying shock when it arrives.
Well, one of the pieces in here is about sitting in a chair, and another piece is about bones, my bones. Some of them are more specifically about things like that, like arthritis or whatever, or not being able to remember people's names. But I think also just to be ready to let go of what you have to let go of is what it really comes down to anyway, because you don't need to anticipate too much of the terrible things that might happen that haven't happened yet, but still to just keep practicing letting go so that when the time comes to let go of something, you can do that, and also that you don't necessarily feel it as just a loss, because letting go is also kind of lightening up, and it can, and there might be something else there that you couldn't see before you let go of the other thing. So. Or if you can't play tennis anymore, then you can play shuffleboard. There's some reason why old people obviously play shuffleboard. And then if you can't do that, maybe learn to play bridge. Or I don't know. There's different things. You can just keep going through the next gate. And sometimes we have to let go of things unexpectedly too. We can't predict what we're going to have to let go of and what we're going to lose.
I heard an interview with Julie Andrews the other day. And she was saying how painful it was when she lost her voice, emotionally how painful.
Wow.
And she started writing with her granddaughter, her daughter. And her daughter said, well, Mother, you're just using your voice in a different way.
Yeah, that's great.
And that brought her so much joy.
Yeah.
When her daughter said that, she said, you're absolutely right.
That's a great story, yeah. It's a good example of making a transition to the next stage, really. The loss is not a loss only, it's a gain in another way. Mm-hmm. How old is she now? She must be getting on.
I can hear that part of the energy.
She must be in her 80s.
Yeah. That old, really?
Her pushing age must be around that.
Yeah, late 70s at least.
Yeah.
Late 70s at least, yeah.
In a lot of creative fields, certainly I know this is true in science, a lot of people's most creative work is done when they're in their 20s.
Yeah.
And like in mathematics,
yeah.
The early 20s are the period of the most creative output, and then after that, they're
next time is great.
Oh, yeah. And it's something that I actually am very interested in, because it's possible that my creative years are already behind me. But I've also talked with people in other fields, like apparently playwrights are known to reach their peak much, much later in life.
Well, I was going to tell you,
yeah.
Maybe you should switch fields.
Yes.
As you get older, find the right field for
right.
that. Because then some musicians and composers, too. I mean, Verdi was in his 70s composing his greatest work. And yeah, there are quite a few people in other creative fields who can do things for a long time, and some writers, too.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I've read that about mathematicians and kind of inventors, people who are really sort of. Well, what about Einstein, though? Was he?
He did his great work when he was in his early 20s.
He was in his early 20s.
He never did anything important after that.
Yeah, I guess I did.
Very nice man.
He played the violin very nicely in his whole bit.
And he came out against the war, and he had
right.
pulpit from which to speak.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
But it also relates to the idea of retirement.
Yeah, yeah.
And what that means is, in my own life, I haven't seen a lot of really positive examples of retirement.
Yeah. Well, I hate that word.
I know,
retirement. True. You know, and I retired from one job, but I don't feel like I'm a retired person in the world. But, and that's a big thing for people. It's a big transition, really. It is. But, I was just going to say something else about. Old people. But I forgot. Have you seen your mama?
Yeah. I'll come back.
Yeah. Oh, well, I guess I was going to say my grandmother was the one who took so long to make the sandwich was a good example for me. She was a sculptor, and she was a very professional and skillful sculptor who did statues for gardens and libraries and parks and things. And she worked right up to the end of her life, and she died in her 80s. And her work, I mean, she was still very creative and involved in her work, so that was a nice reminder. But I do think that it's nice to have models also of people who aren't necessarily doing that kind of great work, but, I mean, you can be old and retired and, sitting in your armchair telling stories to your grandchildren, or you can be a Zen teacher, or you can be doing... There are lots of ways to make a contribution that are much quieter and less achievement-oriented, in a sense. So I don't think we have to worry too much about not having anything to do or any way to give.
I want to read the part about sitting in the chair. Because I'm starting to have terrible knee problems. I used to run long distances, which would start it. I do yoga, but that doesn't seem to be the problem, but I can't sit cross-legged anymore, and eventually I won't be able to sit like this either. Mm-hmm. But I always feel when I sit in a chair that I'm not really sitting.
Well, I can really understand that.
Okay. Yeah.
I felt that too for a while, and because you have a very strong association, there's a sort of mind-body association, so when you're sitting in a chair, it's hard, it takes a little while, and now I actually, for me, I sit in a chair in a way that I don't usually sit in a chair. I mean, I don't, I don't have my back against the back of the chair, I keep my spine upright, but I'm not uncomfortable, although, in a long sashimi or something, I can still have nice sharp pains between my shoulder blades to reassure me that life is not a bowl of cherries yet. But it has finally become for me a meditation posture, and it feels like sort of something about the feeling of my feet flat on the floor in front of me feels good. So there's hope.
Okay.
Don't worry. And I also think it's wonderful that Like Russ and Joe are completely supportive of however you have to sit, and we're just saying that. And I mean, some places it isn't like that. You know, there still are places where you feel like you're being a real wuss if you sit in a chair. And I that's changing, thankfully. It's definitely changing. But there's a high proportion, I think, higher than normal proportion of people who get knee surgery, need knee surgery among Zen practitioners, higher than the general population, probably.
Oh, well, Roshi Jones sits in a chair.
Well, she had a terrible accident.
She did, so, you know, but she... Anyway. And I also have a friend who's just about to retire, and she sent me this email, and she said, oh, I'm so looking forward, we can do things together, we can go check out nursing home. Julia, we have a lot more things to do. Stick with me, kid. Nursing homes are going to be the last. Not any part of it.
Yeah, maybe not. But you know, I think that does bring up what you said and what you said, Russ. Also, there's a delicate balance between sort of worrying of yourself into older age than you even are yet or need to be, but also not pretending to be younger than you are and sort of fighting it endlessly and, you know, trying all kinds of physical and cosmetic surgical ways or whatever to make yourself be younger than you are. I mean, there's nothing evil about doing that. It's just that it's kind of a losing battle. So
it's
you have to be able to get ready, but you also have to be able to just be as vigorous as you can be.
One of my favorite books on aging is Ram Dass's Still Here.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's really wonderful.
And I found that, I read that within the last 2 years, and I found that so inspiring to have the words of somebody who identified so strongly with his vigorous, youthful self kind of fess up to the realities of his own conflict with aging and immortality or mortality and impermanence and the struggle that that poses even the most enlightened of us so come to believe anyway and it's an opportunity to revisit reality over and over
and also the gift of that book is kind of like what I was saying in the beginning, that he's really making the gift of his own authentic self. He's sharing his who he is at that time, still here after that stroke. You know, he's really sharing himself. And that's such a gift to the rest of us. Yeah. Maybe it's time for us to stop and go have some tea. We do have some copies of the book out or next door if anybody wants it. And well, nice to be here with you. Thank you.
And your readings were lovely.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful book.
Thank you.
I agree.
Thank you. Yeah, so when we're done here, everybody can come on over next door for tea and leftover Halloween candy. And time to socialize. And yeah, if you want a book.